In the past couple of episodes, we've been defining wisdom and talking about where it comes from. In today's episode, I want to explore where wisdom is found in the Bible and how Scripture presents wisdom. To learn more, join me for today's episode of All Things Apostolic. In the Bible, there are books that are considered wisdom literature, and there are books or parts of books that display some wisdom features. This means that these writings address how the world works. They help us to see how we fit in the world and what it means to live wisely. We're going to start by talking about books in the Bible that include some features of wisdom. One is Song of Songs or Song of Solomon. It is a collection of love poetry that celebrates God's good gift of physical intimacy between a man and a woman. It's not explicitly educational like Proverbs, and it doesn't openly discuss wisdom like Ecclesiastes or Job, but it does reflect God's desire for love to be faithful, exclusive, and even passionate. And the woman teaches the daughters of Jerusalem in the way of love, similar to the father teaching his son in Proverbs. The book of Psalms includes some wisdom themes. Psalm 1 is a classic example. It's kind of like a proverb in the way that it divides humanity into the two categories of righteous and wicked. Psalm 1 confronts the reader with a choice between righteousness and folly. There are other wisdom psalms, but the placement of Psalm 1 as the very first psalm in the book puts wisdom in the mind of the reader from the very start. Dave Bland and David Fleer say it this way: Psalm 1 functions like a gatekeeper to the book of Psalms, imagined as a literary sanctuary of intimate verbal fellowship with God. That's good enough that I want to repeat that one again. Psalm 1 functions like a gatekeeper to the book of Psalms, imagined as a literary sanctuary of intimate verbal fellowship with God. Sometimes even in the narrative portions of Scripture, we can see the principles of wisdom being illustrated by the actions of godly characters. Joseph is a good example. In Genesis chapter 39, by refusing to be lured and seduced by Potiphar's wife, Joseph exemplified the ethics of Proverbs. He refused the strange foreign woman. But then this is also a great example of how the rewards of wisdom are not always absolute. Joseph showed wisdom by refusing Potiphar's wife, but rather than being blessed, he was thrown into prison. However, in the broad scope of his story, what looked like a setback was really a setup, because it was in prison that he met Pharaoh's chief cupbearer. And we know that the result was his rise to power and his ability to sustain his family through the famine. Now, wisdom is not just found in the Old Testament. An example of a New Testament book that contains wisdom is the book of James. Chapter 1, verse 5 says, "If any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God, that giveth to all men liberally, and upbraideth not, and it shall be given him." We can receive wisdom by drawing near to God and asking for it in faith. In chapter 3, verse 17, James discusses true and false wisdom. Earthly, sensual, devilish wisdom leads to bitter envying and strife. But the wisdom that is from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, and easy to be entreated, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality and without hypocrisy. So there is wisdom sprinkled throughout the Bible, but I want to focus today on the three primary books that are considered wisdom literature in the Old Testament: Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and Job. Proverbs is probably the book everyone primarily associates with wisdom. The first part of the book, chapters 1 through 9, contains speeches of a father to a son. The father covers many topics, but none more than women. The son must avoid promiscuous women and have a strong and healthy relationship with his wife. This part of the book also includes woman wisdom talking to all of the men walking on the path of life. The father's teachings to the son parallel the admonition to avoid woman folly and have a healthy relationship with woman wisdom. The second part of the book, chapters 10 through 31, contains proverbs, which are pithy observations, admonitions, and prohibitions that encourage wise behavior and discourage foolish behavior. The book ends in chapter 31 with an acrostic poem about the virtuous woman who is the embodiment of woman wisdom. As an aside, remember that the order of books is different in the Hebrew Bible than in the English Bible. And interestingly, in the Hebrew Bible, after the book of Proverbs, which concludes with a discussion of the virtuous woman, the next book is Ruth, who is called a virtuous woman in chapter 3. Then Ruth is followed by the Song of Songs, which consists of love poems. So there is a really neat transition from woman wisdom in Proverbs to the virtuous woman in Proverbs 31, to the example of virtuous Ruth, and then to the woman passionately in love in the Song of Songs. Before we discuss the other wisdom books, I want to mention a common misconception that Proverbs chapters 10 through 31 are secular in nature. Some scholars believe that these chapters do not have any theological significance because God is only occasionally mentioned, and they just seem to offer good practical advice. But the proverb should be read in the broader context of the whole book. Remember that the first part of the book establishes or provides an important contrast between woman wisdom and woman folly. We know that woman wisdom is a representation of God, and woman folly can be understood as false gods trying to lure Israel away from the true God. So one way to look at the Proverbs in chapters 10 through 31 is to view them through this lens. The admonitions can be viewed in a very practical way, but when they are viewed theologically, they give us insight into the choices between wisdom and folly, which ultimately represents those who live for God and those who don't. For example, Proverbs chapter 10, verse 1 says that a wise son maketh a glad father, but a foolish son is the heaviness of his mother. This can be seen in a very straightforward, practical way, that a wise child is pleasing to his parents. When viewed through a theological lens, if the choice is between woman wisdom and woman folly, then the wise child is one who chooses to live for God, which makes his parents glad. And the foolish child is one who does not live for God, and that brings heaviness to his parents. Another example is chapter 10, verse 4, which says, "He becometh poor that dealeth with a slack hand, but the hand of the diligent maketh rich." We can see this as a very straightforward, practical piece of advice that hard work will generate wealth, and lazy people will probably be poor. Thinking through a theological lens in this verse, laziness is presented as foolish behavior, like those who do not worship the true God and are poor in spiritual things. In contrast, hard workers are wise, like those who worship God and they are rich in spiritual things. There are many proverbs that make sense when they are viewed from a theological perspective, in addition to the practical perspective. Another example is chapter 5, verses 3 through 4. "For the lips of a strange woman drop as an honeycomb, and her mouth is smoother than oil. But her end is bitter as wormwood, sharp as a two-edged sword." This verse can literally refer to a lewd woman who entices men with fleshly lust, and there may seem to be some pleasure in the beginning, but the result will ultimately be very bitter. But keeping the framework of woman wisdom and woman folly, this could also refer to the temptation to idolatry and false doctrine, leading men from the worship of the true God into false doctrine, with fatal consequences. Another important wisdom book in the Old Testament is Job. Job was a faithful man who lost everything, and then later it was restored. Job's friends suggested that he must have been guilty of some great sin because, in alignment with the worldview of Proverbs, bad things usually happen only to the wicked. For Job, the message of Proverbs didn't appear to be working. He questioned if the lamp of the wicked really does go out, because he'd been living righteously, and yet he had suffered terribly. In the end, God appeared to Job, and the reader learns that God's ways are often beyond the comprehension of man. And the book provides a reassurance that regardless of what happens, God is in control. The third key book of wisdom in the Old Testament is the book of Ecclesiastes. The book begins by saying, "Vanity of vanities, saith the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity." The gist of the book seems to be Solomon's disillusionment about the way that the world works. He seems to be saying that everything is meaningless. But the book makes more sense if we think of it theologically, that it's really about life without God. We don't know when Solomon wrote the book of Ecclesiastes, but I tend to think it was later in life. He was no longer the man who walked with God and talked with God and desired to lead Israel with godly wisdom. Instead, by this stage of life, Solomon, the wisest man in the world and the author of most of the Proverbs, had loved many strange women and had burned incense in high places. He had done evil in the sight of the Lord. It would have been natural for him later in life to conclude that life is meaningless. Life under the sun, our earthly life, doesn't always make sense. On the other hand, although many of the passages seem negative, Solomon also proclaimed in the book that what we do in this world will have eternal consequences. Fearing God is the key to mercy and God's acceptance of us as his children, and only those who fear God and trust in him will experience eternal happiness. In chapter 9, Solomon wrote that the righteous and the wise and their works are in the hand of God. We have to look to God for meaning and not our circumstances. Now that we've introduced the three main wisdom books, I want to discuss a few issues related to them. Some of you may have heard of the term retribution theology. In a nutshell, it means that you get what you deserve. Good people are blessed and bad people are punished. And there is truth to this overarching principle. The structure of the covenant with Israel was connected with blessings and curses. If Israel kept the law, then Israel was blessed. But if Israel broke the law, then there would be curses or consequences. The book of Proverbs has the same type of dynamic. Wisdom leads to reward, but rejecting wisdom and embracing folly causes disaster and ultimately death. But an important misconception about Proverbs is that sometimes they're treated like promises, or that they must be true in every circumstance. Think about Proverbs chapter 10, verse 4 that we talked about a few minutes ago. Is it true that lazy people are always poor? Not if they've inherited money. Do hardworking people always get rich? No. The point is that even though there are exceptions, the Proverbs are true most of the time, and they provide general direction to the majority of people on how to live to achieve a desired result. We've all probably heard the well-known proverb, "Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it." If the parents train up the child well, then the child will live for God their whole life. This fits with the wisdom framework that acting wisely leads to good consequences and acting foolishly leads to trouble. But a proverb is not a promise or a guarantee. It doesn't promise that if parents train their children in the proper way, that they will automatically become godly. What the proverb does is to advocate the best course of action to reach a desired goal. Parents need to do what they need to do. And if they do, then the desired outcome is much more likely, but not assured. We can also see this in proverbs that frequently use better than. These proverbs use relative values and imply that a wise person may sometimes have to choose between values. For example, Proverbs 15:16 says, "Better is little with the fear of the Lord than great treasure and trouble therewith." And Proverbs 16:8 says, "Better is a little with righteousness than great revenues without right." The Proverbs show that living wisely doesn't automatically mean that someone will be more prosperous. Sometimes a person may have to choose living right in the fear of the Lord over wealth or prosperity. So, what is the relationship between Proverbs and Ecclesiastes and Job? The general message of the book of Proverbs connects wise actions to positive consequences and foolish actions to negative consequences. It seems pretty straightforward, and it's true most of the time. But as I already mentioned, it's not true all of the time. And this is where the books of Ecclesiastes and Job have an important role in the biblical canon. Ecclesiastes questions the usefulness of wisdom. Why passionately pursue wisdom when it doesn't necessarily lead to rewards, and death is going to visit the wise and the foolish? Job illustrates the limits of wisdom. Job was the epitome of a wise and righteous man, and yet he suffered greatly. His three friends presented themselves as wise people who pointed to the problem as retribution theology. He must be suffering because he did something bad. So there is some tension between these books, but they don't contradict each other. They all seek to answer, what does it mean to live wisely? If I live wisely, what should I expect? And they offer different perspectives. Together, they provide a more complex portrait. Some people will relate to Proverbs because they'll make wise decisions and it will all work out. Some people will relate to Job because they'll make wise decisions and still suffer tragedy. And some will relate to Ecclesiastes because they may wonder sometimes if it's all worth it. And some people will experience all three of these in one lifetime. Reading all three books is important in order to give us a fuller view of wisdom. They help us grapple with the issue of why good people suffer and bad people prosper. These are deep questions that we as humans struggle with. Instead of giving a simplistic view of life, together, these books offer a more complex and nuanced perspective of the human experience. Old Testament scholar Christopher Wright explains, "The most challenging difference between the wisdom writings and the rest of the Old Testament arises when wisdom authors express doubt about or question the validity of some of the mainline affirmations of the other parts of the Bible. And yet this is precisely the purpose of this material in the canon of Scripture, to compel us towards an honest faith that's willing to acknowledge the presence of doubts we cannot dismiss and questions we can't always fully answer, given our human limitations." I want to conclude by talking briefly about wisdom and Jesus. The New Testament presents Jesus as the epitome of wisdom. Luke chapter 2, verse 40 tells us that Jesus was filled with wisdom as he grew. When he reached maturity and taught the crowds, they were amazed by his teaching because he showed unprecedented wisdom. He even taught using parables, which was typical for a sage. people would have recognized Jesus as a wisdom teacher. In Matthew chapter 11, verse 19, Jesus spoke to the multitudes and said that wisdom is justified of her children. Jesus is that wisdom. In Colossians chapter 1, verses 15 through 20, much of the description of Jesus echoes that of woman wisdom. The picture of woman wisdom is a metaphor of God as the teacher of his people. In the New Testament, Jesus being associated with woman wisdom is meant to inform his followers that in him are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. If we apply the choice between wisdom and folly, we recognize that the choice is really between Jesus and anything that would rival him as the most important thing in our lives. Thank you for joining me for today's episode of All Things Apostolic. And until next time, take care and God bless.